It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beat here reporting differing views among Israeli and American leaders over Iran nuclear talks. On the eve of an address to a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told a pro-Israel lobby, both Israel and the U.S. agree on the need to keep Iran from getting nuclear weapons, but disagree on how to achieve the goal. He says the disagreement grows out of differing perspectives because Washington worries about security. Israel must be concerned about its survival.
The purpose of my address to Congress tomorrow is to speak up about a potential deal with Iran that could threaten the survival of Israel.
In an interview with Reuters, President Obama said there is a substantial disagreement between his administration and the Israeli government over how to achieve their shared goal of preventing Tehran from acquiring nuclear weapons. But he asked for time to let the negotiations play out.
If, in fact, a deal is arrived at, that it's going to be a deal that is most likely to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held more talks Monday with his Iranian counterpart, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, in Switzerland. Chadian troops have reportedly driven Boko Haram Islamist militants out of the northeast Nigerian town of Dikwa. Reuters reports Chad lost one soldier, but several militants were reportedly killed. Meanwhile, Baiwang Mahamat of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says Boko Haram attacks have forced many Nigerian refugees to seek safety in Chad. Many came using boats to escape the fighting. Some drowned on Lake Chad making the attempt. The UN estimates more than 150,000 Nigerians have fled to other countries. Meanwhile, Nigeria's military says Boko Haram militants launched another attack on the northeast town of Kunduga, but were repelled. This is VOA News. Iraqi troops and militia fighters attacked Islamic State militants in a key area north of Baghdad Monday, the first full day of a highly publicized offensive to recapture the city of Tikrit. The operation includes some 830,000 members of Iraq's military, Shia militia, and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. The IS group has held Tikrit since June, when the militants stormed across northern Iraq, capturing Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city. The United Nations is urging donors, organizations, and countries fighting Ebola in West Africa not to give in to complacency. While UN experts say the spread of the disease has dropped to about 10% of what it was in September, Special UN Envoy David Nabarro says the fight has entered a new phase of reaching zero cases. He said that could be painstaking and difficult. Ebola has infected nearly 24,000 and killed more than 9,600. Meanwhile, all Liberian schools reopened for classes Monday after being closed over the Ebola epidemic. Azariah Gole, father of two children, is happy the schools are open again.
It's very important for my children to go back to school, and not only my alone, but all the parents, because during this Ebola crisis, the children are left idle. Okay, they are not studying no longer, they don't read, and some of them are not getting used to book anymore. Some of them, when you ask them, the geographic location of Liberia, they don't know it because they've been out of school for so many months. So the children going back to school at this time is very much welcoming news.
Students were forced to stay home for 7 months. Many had followed some of their studies by listening to radio. Secretary of State Kerry is urging the United Nations to investigate human rights abuses in separatist-controlled eastern Ukraine, where thousands have been killed in nearly a year of violence.
In Crimea and in the separatist control areas of eastern Ukraine, men, women, and children are being killed. They're being tortured. They're being raped and sexually assaulted, detained arbitrarily, abducted for ransom, forced into labor, prosecuted and persecuted because of who they are and where they worship.
Mr. Kerry spoke before the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva following talks with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who told the Human Rights Forum tangible progress has been achieved concerning the ceasefire in Ukraine. He urged Kiev to distance itself from what he called extremists. The United Nations says it now fears hundreds of boys were abducted last month in South Sudan and forcibly recruited as child soldiers. A UN spokesman said Monday the UN Children's Fund UNICEF believes the number of children abducted in Upper Nile State is much higher than the 89 originally reported. UNICEF says it believes the suspected kidnappers are from a militia aligned with South Sudan's military. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's military says its offensive against Boko Haram is achieving its intended goals.
The operations put together by the Nigerian Armed Forces and security agencies have been progressing as expected and achieving the required results. This has been backed by the activities of the multinational joint task force.
Major General Chris Olukolade is the Director of Defense Information for Nigeria's military. What led to Sunday's mob killing of a Nigerian woman? South Sudan peace talks continue today in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Sudanese rebels are suspected of elephant poaching in Cameroon. And could Lesotho be headed for a coalition government?
I think the fact that, you know, we might be headed towards a coalition government in Lesotho is not at all surprising. I think that's what many people expected from the very outset.
Jeff Smith is Africa specialist at the Robert F. Kennedy Justice and Human Rights. And an effort is underway to increase access to electricity in Africa. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A senior Nigerian military official says the operation against Boko Haram, put together by the Nigerian Armed Forces and backed by the multinational joint task force, is progressing and achieving its intended goals. Major General Chris Olukolade, Director of Defense Information, says the joint task force is also adjusting its tactics to counter what seems to be Boko Haram's new mode of attacks, which is guerrilla warfare. This comes as latest reports say Boko Haram gunmen attack an island on the Niger side of Lake Chad on Monday, with locals reporting heavy casualties. Major General Olukolade said the multinational joint task force will defend any coalition member against any Boko Haram attacks.
Well, the offensive on the terrorists is continuing as planned and achieving required results. All the identified cells have been either bombarded or assaulted on the ground, and those operations have been completed are undergoing cordon and search by troops with a view to recovering all arms that is in their possession and also apprehending any one of them that might be hiding in the vicinity of the places that have been cleared. In the course of their being dislodged, we are aware that some of them are engaging in suicide bombing activities, and in the course of their retreat, they are perpetrating one havoc or the other.
That's exactly so, Major General. As you mentioned, is it possible now that Boko Haram has switched its tactics to one of guerrilla warfare, and is the military ready to deal with that?
Well, this has been the pattern of their operation even before now. Before now, they decided to adopt the style of ISIS, wanting to hold on to territories. What they were doing mainly had been more of guerrilla warfare. And we're adjusting our tactics to contain them accordingly. One explanation for the present successes in fighting them is that there has been ongoing training even in the battlefront, and our troops are adjusting to the various tricks they're up to.
And talking about troops adjusting, what about the African Union or regional force? Has it been put in place?
Well, I'm not in a position to speak about that now. All I just know is that the operations put together by the Nigerian Armed Forces and security agencies have been progressing as expected and achieving the required results. This has been backed by the activities of the multinational joint task force, who are within the various contiguous borders to Nigeria by virtue of the existing multinational joint task force under the auspices of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, who, even before this time, had been composed to deal with the issues of armed banditry and terrorism in the region. They are the ones backing the operation from Nigeria to ensure that anyone who is escaping from Nigeria does not have a hiding place in any neighboring country.
The latest we hear is that this Boko Haram has attacked an island on the Niger side of Lake Chad. Is it possible they are trying to divide this regional force by doing these kind of attacks? Is it possible that this might discourage, say, a country like Chad?
That will definitely not be achieved. That's the intention, because this coalition is also meant to confront that type of situation, in the sense that any of these countries that come under attack, there's the freedom of action on the part of the force to go after them and assist whoever in containing them.
Major General Chris Olukolade is Director of Defense Information for Nigeria's military. He was speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria.
A tragic mix-up in the Nigerian city of Bauchi on Sunday led to a mob killing of a woman wrongfully suspected of being a suicide bomber. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Abuja.
For the past several months, authorities at the Muda Lawal market in Bauchi have hired civilian guards, sometimes called vigilantes, to search incoming shoppers and vehicles as a way of protecting the market from gunmen and bombers. When a woman approached the entrance to the fruits and vegetables section wearing an overcoat, her refusal to be searched quickly turned deadly. Ibrahim Musa saw what happened. Musa says the vigilantes were suspicious of the woman from the moment they first saw her. They insisted she be searched, but she resisted, leading to an altercation with people in the market. Musa says she was escorted out and then came back along with a man in an army uniform. She resumed arguing with the vigilantes until the soldier left, at which point Musa says the vigilantes attacked her. They beat her, then put tires on her, and set her ablaze. No bomb was found on the woman's body. Like many cities in northeastern Nigeria, Bauchi has been bombed in recent months by the extremist group Boko Haram, which has been fighting to impose their strict version of Islamic law across the northeast. They've taken over swaths of the region and sent suicide bombers to assault public places, including a market in Bauchi in December. An offensive by multinational military forces in recent weeks has pushed Boko Haram out of some of their strongholds in the northeast. But security experts believe the insurgents will step up guerrilla tactics, like bombings, as they lose territory, particularly as the March 28th presidential election nears. Bawa Abdullahi Wase, a security analyst and associate at the Network for Justice, says the fear caused by Boko Haram's random bombing was a catalyst for the killing of the woman, who has still not been identified.
Nigerians should be prepared for more incidents like this because there is desperation. People want to cause confusion. People want to make sure that they disrupt the system of this election that is coming up this month at all costs. So as long as this be the case, as we know it is, then definitely people should be prepared to see more of this.
Police in Bauchi say they are looking for the people that killed the woman, but have made no arrests yet. Community leader Zubair Yakubu condemned the slaying.
As it turned out to be that she was not a Boko Haram member, this is a gruesome murder, and I will call on our people to please calm down. Don't take the laws into their hands.
Trading at the market continued as usual after the woman was killed. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has congratulated the people of Lesotho for participating peacefully in Saturday's parliamentary election. In a statement on Monday, Mr. Kerry said the United States shares the hopes of the Basotho that these elections will allow Lesotho to move beyond a period of political uncertainty and strengthen national unity. This comes as latest results from the election show Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's All Basotho Convention Party with 40 seats and former Prime Minister Mr. Pakalita Musilili's Democratic Congress Party with 33 seats. There are suggestions that if the results hold, Lesotho could be headed for a coalition government. Jeff Smith is Africa specialist at the Robert F. Kennedy Justice and Human Rights. He says he's not surprised by the results.
Sure, I think the fact that, you know, we might be headed towards a coalition government in Lesotho is not at all surprising. I think that's what many people expected from the very outset, and I think that's why many people worried about potential instability in the post-election period.
But do you think that Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's or Basotho Convention Party can enter into any coalition, say, for example, his nearest rival, the Democratic Congress of former Prime Minister? Is it possible this can happen, given the kind of tension that's been going on there?
Absolutely. I think that can definitely happen. I remain very optimistic about Lesotho. If you saw today, the Southern African Development Community Observer Mission declared that the elections are peaceful, they are transparent, the word credible, they used the words free and fair. And I think that is a positive first step. But thereafter, I think the important thing, if it's Thabane leading a coalition, or if it's Metsing, or if it's Musa Sili, depending on the three, I think there are two key factors. I think it's acceptance of the outcome by all parties, including the SADC observers, which I think still have a very key role to play in maintaining stability and a peaceful environment that we saw throughout the entire electoral period. And secondly, is the relationship between the elected leaders that I just mentioned and the country's security apparatus, especially in light of what happened last August. And, you know, the big issue there, although those are the two key main factors, the key to unlocking Lesotho's immediate and long-term long-term stability will be for its leaders to embrace a strategy of compromise. And this is not unprecedented in Lesotho. We've seen this happen over and over again. But we need these politicians to overcome, you know, the political posturing and self-interest that we may see in other countries and that we have seen in Lesotho in the past. That's really going to be the key because, you know, the latter approach, the self-interested politics approach has certainly led Lesotho astray. But as I said, I do remain optimistic, and I think a coalition government, one that is peaceful and one that is premised on these more benevolent personal ambitions, is certainly possible.
You mentioned the SADC observer mission, and even the African Union observer team has described Saturday's vote as peaceful, but it also expressed concern. The African Union team expressed concern about continuing insecurity. That is of concern to many people. How can Lesotho overcome that?
You're right. There are still concerns given what happened in Lesotho's not so distant past that, you know, instability could arise. But I think to this point, the rhetoric from all the major politicians involved, the fact that the military and the security forces stayed in their barracks during the electoral process, both of those are very positive signs. I think there's a lot of goodwill in the country amongst all parties. And let's face it, Lesotho in this election, as in past elections, has raised the electoral bar for elections in not only SADC, but throughout Africa.
Jeff Smith is Africa specialist at the Robert F. Kennedy Justice and Human Rights. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Peace talks between South Sudan's warring parties continue today, Tuesday, in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program, who is attending the talks, brings us up to date.
Ethiopian diplomat Seyoum Mesfin has been the lead mediator at the 13-month-old peace talks for South Sudan. He says IGAD expects to bring Mr. Kiren Machar together for talks as early as tomorrow.
They will be asked to discuss only three issues. A, the structure of the government, particularly the top level, the president, first vice president, or the president, prime minister, and vice president. The second is the power-sharing ratios of the cabinet and the National Assembly. And the third one is the status of forces. Do they want one army during the transition, two armies and so on?
Delegates from the two warring parties have not agreed on many of the key issues highlighted by Seyoum. IGAD says in a power-sharing proposal signed by Mr. Kiir and Machar early last month that the transitional government should be in place as of July 9th. South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makui says delegates for the warring parties have been meeting at committee levels for more than a week, trying to iron out lingering differences and pave way for a peace deal.
Today we have completed the presentation, and the mediators will thereafter sit and try to harmonize these variant positions and come up with a harmonized document that will now be the subject of agreement or disagreement in the near future.
IGAD mediators have been studying the proposal from the two sides, from civil society activists, faith-based groups, and representatives of former political detainees. IGAD will give a final peace document to Mr. Kiir and Machar in the next few days, and the two leaders are expected to sign the deal. The international community has warned both men that if no peace deal is reached, more sanctions will be imposed on South Sudanese leaders. The chief negotiator for Machar's group says there are still issues that are blocking the road to peace. Diu Matok Ding agrees that one of the critical issues that need to be resolved is the structure of the army during the transitional period. Matok says in its current form, South Sudan's army cannot protect the country's citizens.
Our position as opposition that we must have to form amalgamated unit, which are going to be the basis of the nuclear army of South Sudan during the pre-transitional period. They will be tasked with the responsibility of protecting the BIPs, with protecting the population, with protecting the civilian.
The two parties have also not agreed on financial issues, including how to share South Sudan's wealth. The hope in Addis Ababa is that a final peace deal will be signed this week, and nearly 15 months of violence in South Sudan will come to an end. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza in Addis Ababa.
Cameroon's military says it killed several suspected Sudanese Janjaweed rebels who were poaching elephants in a national park. The militiamen have killed about 20 elephants during the past week and have been engaged in gun battles with security forces since invading the parks. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde, the rebels are believed to be selling elephant tusks to fund their rebellion.
Speaking after a visit to the Buba Jida National Park in northern Cameroon, Jean-Jacques Leboa of the Anti-Poaching Department of the Economic Community of Central African States said the rebels used sophisticated weapons, some of which are believed to have come from Libya after the war that destabilized the country. He said the militiamen use proceeds from ivory sales, especially in Asian countries, to fund their activities.
Illegal wildlife trafficking is considered to be the fourth, depending on how you count, the third or fourth biggest transnational criminal activity in the world, behind human trafficking, weapons trafficking, and drug trafficking. It is valued at between 8 and 10 billion U.S. dollars per year. When you're talking about this much money, you combine it with an illegal activity, you have corruption. Corruption at every single level of this chain, which begin and ends in East Asia, but which transits through Central Africa.
Researcher Thomas Ewing of the Washington-based C4ADS, an organization helping African countries uncover illicit networks of elephant poaching and illegal ivory trading, says many armed groups in Central African states are involved in wildlife crimes.
I can't tell you how much a terrorist group might make from ivory or if a given terrorist group engages in ivory trade, but I can say that a wide range of destabilizing actors in different African states seem to be engaged in this trade.
International wildlife organizations blame rebel groups for the slaughter of almost 12,000 elephants in Central African countries since 2004. They say the rebels are working with corrupt government officials to sell the ivory to Asia to finance their insurgencies. The government of Cameroon deployed its military to protect national parks in the north of the country after they lost nearly 2,000 elephants between 2012 and 2013. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
More than 600 million people living in Africa do not have access to electricity. The Energy Access Ventures Fund was established this week to help 1 million of those residents in the region gain access by 2020. French company Schneider Electric, along with several development agency partners, announced they have set up a 54.5 million euro fund to help increase access throughout Africa. Christopher Pauline, Sustainable Investment Director for Schneider Electric, tells Ricky Stryer how they hope to make this goal a reality.
What we did announce is the creation of an impact investment fund in partnership with major development financing agencies to promote access to electricity in rural Eastern Africa. Eastern Africa, as a first stage. And then on a second stage, some countries in Western Africa.
And it's 54.5 million euros that are going toward this project, correct?
Yes. It's the total commitment of all the partners is that amount.
What kind of projects and businesses will that money go toward?
This one is going to be invested in small and medium-sized companies that are providing access to electricity, which means either distributing or manufacturing solar home systems, or implementing and operating mini-grids, or even having new innovative financing means for the consumers.
And you mentioned East Africa. Can you be specific about some of the region you guys are focusing on for this project and why you're focusing on those regions?
We are going to focus very specifically on mainly Kenya, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Burundi. We decided to focus on this area because, first of all, we wanted to focus because we wanted to be on the ground, to have a deep inside knowledge of the market. And then we decided to start focusing on these countries because this is where there are the most activities in the access to the electricity field.
It says 20 small and medium African businesses will be supported. That seems like not that many businesses for that large amount of money. You know, how are you going to choose which businesses to support? What kind of oversight will there be to make sure that the money is actually going toward the population getting access to electricity as opposed to the pockets of business owners without actually helping increase access to electricity?
Well, this is the reason why we've made a partnership with DFIs, just to make sure that we have very strict rules on deciding which are the companies into which we are going to invest and making sure that there is a real reporting on the number of people getting access and the what kind of people are getting access and making sure that the impact targets of the funds will be met.
That was Christopher Pauline, Sustainable Investment Director for Schneider Electric. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Paris. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with volleyball. Hosts Egypt beat Kenya in three straight sets to clinch their sixth Africa Women's Under-20 volleyball title in Cairo on Sunday. At the end of the round-robin contest, Algeria are runners-up ahead of Kenya. Egypt and Algeria qualify for the Women's World Under-20 World Cup Championships in Cyprus in July. Staying in Cairo, Egypt beat Algeria by 3-1 in the final at the African Men's Under-21 Volleyball Championship on Sunday. Morocco were placed third in the contest. Egypt and Algeria qualify for the World Men's Under-21 Championships in Mexico in September. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Sammy Kitwara clocked 28 minutes and 51 seconds to win his fifth outing at the world best 10-kilometer road race in San Juan, Puerto Rico on Sunday. Kitwara previously won the event four times between 2009 and 2013. Meanwhile, Ethiopian World Championship 10,000-meter bronze medalist Belianesh Olgira prevailed in the women's race in 31 minutes and 57 seconds. Moving on to football, Argentina's Hector Cooper is the new Egyptian Pharaoh's coach, the Egypt Football Association president Gamal Alam revealed in Cairo on Monday. Coach Cooper has a huge challenge improving the Pharaoh's fortunes. After three consecutive Orange Africa Cup of Nations victories between 2006 and 2010, the Pharaohs have failed to qualify for Africa's flagship football tournament. They have also never played in the Orange African Nations Championships. Still in Cairo, Egypt outclassed Kenya 3-0 in a men's 2015 All-Africa Games qualifier in Cairo on Sunday. Meanwhile, Egyptian striker Mansulwa scored a first-half goal to lift Egypt to a 1-0 victory over hosts Kenya in a women's international friendly in Machakos, some 65 kilometers southeast of the capital, Nairobi, on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Officials in the United States say a U.S. citizen who fled the country more than 2 years ago and who recently was placed on the FBI's most wanted terrorist list is now in custody in Somalia. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer James Harmon, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
VOA. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.